Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Thank you for joining me here today. Hey, let's begin our time together by lifting up specific prayers for our friends in the 90.5 listening area in Duluth. We know that six people from the Husky Refinery explosion in Superior have been transported to the hospital in Duluth. And so those of you who are in our 90.5 Faith Radio listening area there in Duluth, please know that we are upholding you in our prayers, your community, and those members of your community who are directly affected by this explosion at the Husky Refinery. Also want to be praying for the first responders, want to be praying for those who are even now seeking to restore some order there at the refinery as they were preparing to shut it down for repairs, and now obviously much more extensive repairs than were initially planned. So, Father God, we recognize that you are sovereign over all things. We recognize that sin and danger are real, and that the enemy is at work in the world in a myriad of ways. And so, Father, we simply ask that for those who have been physically injured, you would be the hands and in the spirit of those whose hands are literally upon these people right now in the hospital in Superior. We are in Duluth from Superior, and we ask, Father, that as the great physician, you would bring healing and restoration to their bodies. Father, for those who now have work to do that they would not have otherwise had to do, and those whose lives are disrupted in ways that we can scarcely imagine, Father, we simply ask that you be the one who arrives in peace and calm and restoration of order. You are the God who brings order out of chaos. And so, Father, we entrust this situation to you and continue in our prayers for all of those in our 90.5 Faith Radio listening area in Duluth, Minnesota. All right, friends, I'm going to lead off today with a conversation actually about what's going on around the globe. And part of this is that you have probably heard about this young boy, 23-month-old toddler in the United Kingdom, who is being denied ongoing medical treatment there in Great Britain, but also being denied the opportunity to travel with his parents for some free ongoing medical care that's being offered by the Pope in Italy. And so his name is Alfie Evans. We want to be lifting Alfie and his parents up in our ardent prayers. And we're going to talk about that story actually at the very end of the hour. But because I was going to talk about Alfie today, it reminded me that some of what I want to encourage us to do is to be reading other headlines. And certainly as we recognize the status of Christians who live as religious minorities, not only in secular environments like Great Britain, but in environments where Christianity is dominated by another religion. And we also want to be lifting up other religious minorities in places where, you know, Christianity is a minority religion, but so are other religions as well. I'm thinking here maybe specifically about the Yazidis. And so at least that would be one that we would recognize from the news. And so I want to alert you today to a report that was just released. It's released on an annual basis. Every year this happens. And I want to share it with you because it's about religious freedom, and it's issued by the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom. They have issued their 2018 annual report. And suffice it to say, it's not good news. There's a deterioration of democracies around the world. And when democracy deteriorates, freedom of religion is definitely one of the casualties. And so we're seeing a rise in the persecution of religious minorities by governments and militants of dominant religious influence in certain countries around the world. And so I just, you know, I used the Googler, and my feed popped almost immediately with stories out of China, Nigeria, Turkey, Pakistan, actually two stories from Pakistan, stories from India. The list goes on and on. And so it's all bad news, and it's all related to the persecution of religious people who find themselves as minorities in these countries. And so I'll just give you the headline from each one. China. China is not only tearing down churches, they are now requiring that those that remain open post signs banning children from attending services. I want you to think about that in the context of Jesus saying, "Let the little children come unto me and hinder them not, for as to such as these belongs the kingdom of heaven." In Nigeria, a Fulani herdsman gunned down two priests and 17 worshipers during worship in the nation's capital. In the nation of Turkey, churches are reporting what they now describe as systematic harassment. We also know that Turkey continues to hold our brother Andrew Brunson in prison as well on trumped-up terrorism charges. In Pakistan, the Supreme Court is just now hearing the case of a Christian mother of five who offered a cup of water to a Muslim neighbor in 2010 and was subsequently charged and convicted of blasphemy. She was sentenced to death by hanging. She's been in prison all this time. Yes, let me remind you, that is for giving her neighbor a cup of water. The good news is this case is now before the Supreme Court in Pakistan, so we're holding out hope that that this sentence of death by hanging will not be carried out in this particular case. But here's the reality. She's lost a lot of years with her kids and with her husband during this time over a charge of blasphemy, and her crime was offering a cup of water to a neighbor. Earlier this month in Pakistan, ISIS claimed responsibility for the targeted killings of a Christian family. In India, persecution by the Hindu majority is on the rise. One example of that is that they actually seize people's Bibles and then they burn them in the streets, and not only as a demonstration that they have this sort of vigilante power over their Christian neighbors, but also to take away from those Christians something that is of great value to them, and that would be the Word of God. So the Global Religious Freedom Commission report that was just issued cites 28 key nations that they view as being on a downward trend. This ongoing downward trend in religious liberty worldwide is cause for concern. The commission is calling on the Trump administration to prioritize the release of religious prisoners and to assist in resettling refugees who are fleeing particularly religious persecution. And so the list of the 28 countries you can survey for yourself. Here are some of the things that they cite in the report. They cite a so-called Islamic State genocidal campaign against Christians, Yazidis, and Shiite Muslims. They cite Russia's harsh treatment of Jehovah's Witnesses, Muslims, and Scientologists. And they cite unjust detention of individuals like Andrew Brunson by the nation of Turkey. As it did in 2017, the commission asked the State Department, that's the U.S. State Department, to redesignate 10 nations as countries of particular concern for their egregious religious freedom violations. Those nations are Burma, China, Eritrea, Iran, North Korea, Saudi Arabia, Sudan, Tajikistan, and Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan rounds out the 10. It also reiterated its request that the department add six countries to the list: the Central African Republic, Nigeria, Pakistan, Russia, Syria, and Vietnam. Why lift this up? Well, because we are people here in the United States who live with a level of religious freedom that we must not, ought not, absolutely must not take for granted. And as democracy deteriorates anywhere in the world, so does religious freedom. Certainly, you see the evaporation of key freedoms like the freedom of speech, the freedom of assembly, the freedom to peaceably protest, the freedom of the press. All of these would be happening right now in the nation of Turkey. In fact, the courts there just sentenced dozens of journalists to prison because they accurately reported on the attempted coup there in the summer of 2016. So we need to be praying the news in these cases, but we also need to be thinking about and careful about our own international travel, what we do when we travel internationally, and what we communicate with our international brothers and sisters on social media, certainly what we communicate about them. If you are a person who is in contact with Christians who are living and or serving in any nation under heaven where Christianity is not the dominant religion, please be very, very careful about ever posting anything on social media about those people who are on the front lines of of the advancing gospel today. When you're on the front lines of the advancing gospel, you're also on the front lines of real enemy warfare. Okay, also released yesterday, as you heard in the SRN news report at the top of this hour, was a new Pew Research study in which Americans were simply asked, do you believe in God? And then they were asked, well, if you believe in God, what do you actually believe? And so although you and I might be really excited to learn that 80% or maybe even 90% of Americans believe in God, you can't stop there. The question can't stop there. Because a lot of those people simply believe in what they then describe as a higher power or a spiritual force. They don't actually believe in the God of the Bible. There are contradictions in evidence throughout this Pew Research study in terms of just how confused people in our culture are. Maybe the greatest contradiction comes when we look at the numbers in this study of people who self-identify as Christians. But then they go on to say they do not believe in God. Now, just to be very clear, you cannot be a Christian if you are not at least a theist, a person who believes in God. So the takeaway here is there's a lot of deep confusion in our culture, among our neighbors, even within the church. But there's also a lack of curiosity, a lack of concern at discovering and knowing ultimate truth. Friends, when we come back, I got to take a quick break right now, but when we come back, I'm going to be joined by Abdu Murray. Abdu's the North American director of the Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. He and I are going to be talking about these issues that are surfaced here in this Pew Research report, and we're going to be talking about Saving Truth. It's his new book, and it's the subject of the day. This is Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I'll be right back. Hey friends, this is Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. Joining me now is Abdu Murray. He is a guy about whom that song is absolutely true. Every single word he speaks directs other people to the Lord our God. He is the North American director for Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. And one of the reasons he's here today is to talk about his new book, Saving Truth. But from that subject matter, we're actually just going to talk about the headline news of the day as well. Abdu, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Well, thank you so much, Carmen. It's always a pleasure to be on the show.
Well, thank you. Friends, you can check out what we're talking about today at abdumurray.com. Abdu, reflect with us for a moment on this latest Pew research on what Americans say they believe about God and the Bible. If a person believes just in sort of the notion of a higher power, at least I guess that's an opening to begin a conversation about God, but how is that distinct from a conversation about believing in the reality of the God of the Bible?
Oh, it's quite stark in distinction. I mean, when you think about the idea of believing in a higher power, and I know a lot of people would say that there's a value to that, and a lot of recovery programs actually put stock in that, you know, believing in a higher power helps people recover from certain addictions, and that's probably true. But we're talking about one thing, recovering from addictions or helping you get through life. But ultimately, believing in and believing of the God of the Bible is a different thing. It's not just recovery from certain, sort of mortal problems, but from the mortal problem, which is the problem of sin and death. And absent belief in him and what he's done for us, there's no salvation. So it's not enough to believe that a higher power exists who might be guiding your life or helping you out. It's who is that higher power? Jesus doesn't make the claim, or he doesn't ask the disciples, who do people say that I am, and do you believe in a higher power? He says, who do you say that I am, which is a foundational issue. And Jesus, being the one who was not only God incarnate, but proved he was God incarnate, but rising from the dead, you know, he tends to have some credibility, because guys who rise from the dead tend to have that credibility. And when he asked that question, it's a question we ought to listen to.
So in our conversations with people, you know, today, sort of the man on the street conversations that any of us might be having, you know, I feel like the Pew Research actually, you know, gives us an opening to conversation. You seem to very naturally have these openings to conversation. Like, this is what you guys do at RZIM. And so people come to you with spiritual questions. I'm wondering if we can equip our listeners now to kind of do what you do on a regular basis, and to sort of get over the fear of simply engaging a person who says, well, you know, I kind of believe in spiritual things. I kind of, you know, I believe in a higher power. But I think that whole God of the Bible, you know, that's just meanness, and he's all angry. And equip people to have that personal conversation with another individual.
Absolutely. And I think that this Pew Research Forum findings is so fascinating, because it actually, I think in one sense, it should give Christians a little bit of hope, because like you said, it opens up doors for spiritual conversations. But you can see the muddled confusion, where at once you can say you're a Christian, but I don't believe in God. And another area of the survey says, do you disbelieve in God? And some people, oh, yeah, I don't believe in God, but I believe in some kind of a higher power. Well, what does that mean? That's all confused, right? So it allows us to have the conversations by asking some very, I think, well-worded questions. But one simple one, what do you mean when you say X, Y, or Z? Because people are saying confused things. I think the best way we can actually have clear spiritual conversations is to get clarity through the use of questions. So if someone were to say, you know, I believe in, I'm a spiritual but not religious person. Well, what do you mean by spiritual? And what do you mean by religious? You seem to not like religious, but you like spiritual. What do you mean by these two things? And you get some clarity about what they mean. What the clarity you might end up getting is that they are not at all clear on what they even mean, in which case now we can have an educational conversation. So I'm a big fan of opening up these things with questions. What do you mean by spiritual and that kind of thing? But if they do go this route, as you suggested, that, and I've heard it many, many times before, so it's not a new thing that I don't think anybody who's listening to us has ever heard. They've heard this. Yeah, I believe in a higher power. I'm spiritual. But the God of the Bible seems to be this arbitrary, capricious, mean person who judges people all the time for petty things and all that. I think the great follow-up question is, really, how do you know that? Have you read the Bible? Are you an actual, you know, have you done a study of this? And sometimes the answer is yes, they have. And now you can get into it a little more and open up a Bible and say, well, show me where you see this at. And then you can explain through context. But oftentimes we'll find out, and I think sometimes to our shock, that the people who are most sure about their rejection of Christianity are the people who know the least about it. And if you ask them the question, how do you know that the God of the Bible is this God that you don't like so much? You'll find out they actually don't know. They just heard, or they had a preference that they had. I don't want to be a religious person who succumbs to, or who submits to, I should say, the authority of God. And so I can make him in my image versus having to be conformed to what he would want me to be like. I think that's a starting point. So asking them what do they mean, and then finding out how do they know these things, these I consider false accusations against God. We can go a long way with just those two questions.
So one of the other things that kind of, I'll just admit, shocked me when I read this particular Pew Research report is that over half of adults believe God determines what happens to them most or all of the time. 48% say God or another higher power directly determines what happens in their lives most or all the time. An additional 18% say God or some other higher power determines what happens to them some of the time. So we got a lot of people who even who must profess to believe in God, right? But who believe in fatalism or determinism. So can you help us understand the difference in, you know, the God of the Bible and the reality of free will and free moral agency versus determinism and fatalism?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is actually a question I even get in within Christian circles. Obviously, there's been the, you know, millennia age long debate about, you know, or discussion of where does God's sovereignty and our free will interact, and how is it possible that we could have free will if God is truly sovereign? And there are a lot of people, in fact, other religious persuasions, Islam, for example, certain strands of Islam are extremely deterministic and fatalistic. In fact, I know one Muslim apologist I used to have these dialogues with who would often pray and ask God, do not lead me into apostasy. Please keep me a believer in Islam because you could cause me to go astray. Well, that's horrifying in one sense. I mean, could you imagine waking up every morning wondering if God's going to make you into an unbeliever and change your belief system without your, you know, sort of consent, so to speak? But of course, as Christians, we do believe that God is sovereign and that God has two kinds of wills. And this is where I think the interaction really happens. Instead of this fatalistic, God's going to get you kind of a thing, which I think a lot of people have. I was in a dialogue with an atheist who said he became an atheist because he was freed from the burden of worrying about whether God's going to get him for not worshiping correctly. And I was like, oh my goodness, I reject that same God. But I never did believe in that God you're talking about, you know, that kind of a thing. God has two kinds of will, I think, as we see in the Bible. He has what's called his directive will, the things that he directs to happen by his active agency. And then he has his permissive will. He has things that he allows to happen, that they don't happen without his will, but they also are allowed to happen for purposes I think often we can't see and may never see, because God knows all from the beginning to the end, both actual and possible. So I think we live in a world designed by God, but in a world that's designed by God to allow our free will to be exercised, he knows what's going to happen without determining that it's going to happen. And I think that's an important distinction as well. People often ask, well, if God knows what I'm going to do before I do it, then how am I making any free choices? And the answer is simply that foreknowledge does not mean foredetermination. For example, my wife and I chose to have children. And we knew before they were born that those kids were going to fall down and get scrapes and get cuts and maybe break an arm off of a bicycle accident, and one day, as every human being does, going to die one day. Well, the fact that we chose to have them, knowing all those things ahead of time because we have pretty good knowledge of the human condition, doesn't mean that we caused those things. So those things happen by a permissive will. And God exerts that across the world. And so we don't need to have this sort of fatalistic, whatever will happen kind of view. We have to have moral agency. And by the way, determinism robs us of any moral dignity whatsoever. Our moral choices no longer have a moral dimension to them because we do them because we're determined by it. And I also think that strict determinism is not theistic so much as it's almost non-theistic or atheistic. A lot of atheists will tell you, we're just chemical machines that respond to stimuli. Mm-hmm. Well, you can transfer that to a religious context and have the same exact thing. And the moral agency and the beauty of the gospel, I think, gets lost unless we can reconcile the reality of God's sovereignty and the reality of human moral agency.
Well, Abdu, I know that people who are listening right now are thinking, wow, I want to know how to do that, and I need help with answering the kinds of questions that the next generation is certainly asking of me. Friends, we're going to continue this conversation with Abdu Murray after the break, and we're going to be talking specifically about his book, Saving Truth, Finding Meaning and Clarity in a Post-Truth World. It's going to be released next week, and you have the opportunity to go ahead and pre-order it today. I would encourage you to visit abdumurray.com. Hey, we'll continue this conversation right after the break. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and you are listening to Connecting Faith. Hey, friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. Joining me today is Abdu Murray. He's the North American Director for Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. You know them as RZIM. You can check out what they're doing at rzim.org. You can check out the book we're talking about today, which is Saving Truth, at abdumurray.com. Abdu, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Thanks so much.
All right, let's just talk specifically now about the book, Saving Truth. You know, first of all, let me just go ahead and say, like, if truth is Jesus, he doesn't need saving, and we all know that. That's not what you're trying to say. Why this book at this time? What's going on in our culture that provoked you to write Saving Truth?
Well, it, right from the title, is actually something about the culture has sort of denigrated truth to a lower rung on the ladder, such that it's not as important as it once was. Now, we're not denying that truth exists as a culture. We're just subordinating it to our preferences and our feelings. So in one sense, I want to save truth culturally so that it can be part of the cultural conversation once again and be back into the Western mindset. But also, I want to bring people to a knowledge of the saving truth, the truth that actually saves us and who is Christ himself. So that's sort of the double entendre meant in the title. But in 2016, Oxford English Dictionaries named as its Word of the Year post-truth. And the Word of the Year with Oxford English Dictionaries is a word that captures the ethos and the pathos of what's happening in the culture. And at the end of 2016, with the rise of fake news and the discussions about alternative facts and all these various things, the word post-truth was used 2,000 more times in 2016 since it was first coined in 1992. So what a post-truth culture is one that elevates feelings and preferences above facts and truth. Now, that's not a postmodern culture. A postmodern culture, which we're sort of leaving behind, was a culture that said there is no objective truth. Everything is subjective. And so, you know, you can't say you have the absolute truth and all these things. Which, of course, you can reason with somebody. Ironically, you can reason with somebody like that because you can say to them, well, you're saying there's no such thing as objective truth. Is that claim objectively true? And if they say yes, then their statement is false. And if they say no, then their statement is meaningless. So no matter what they do, you have to believe in objective truth eventually. A post-truth culture is different. They don't deny that objective truth exists. They simply say objective truth does exist and I don't care. It's not as important to me as my preferences and my feelings. So if science happens to get in the way of what I feel like I want to do, say, be, or whatever it might be, well, then science will either be twisted or ignored altogether because my preferences matter more. And that's sort of a cultural virtue now, is that we have confusion, which has become a virtue because it allows us to play at the fuzzy edges of the ideas of truth. But clarity is becoming a sin. So if you're confused, you know, sexually, morally, or religiously, you're a hero, you're progressive, or you're tolerant. But if you're clear, sexually, morally, or religiously, you're a bigot, you're regressive, or you're intolerant. So that's what I think is the impetus for why I wanted to write this book, because as I see on college campuses across the world, frankly, and in different areas, even sadly, even parts of the church, clarity is becoming a sin and confusion is becoming a virtue.
Okay, so now you're terrifying people because I think that, I mean, you are. I mean, like it's important, right? We have to stir up the body because I do think that particularly those of us who sort of learned our apologetics in a propositional way, which is, you know, we have learned how to answer the questions in terms of, you know, okay, well, these two things can't both be true. And so let's work through the fact that one of them, you know, is true and therefore the true idea wins. What you're telling us is the world we live in has now so dramatically changed. We actually have to learn to think like the culture that we now live in, not the culture we used to live in. And so for people who are still operating out of a modernist mindset, they missed a whole postmodern reality. And now we are in a time beyond postmodernism, and we're actually in a time of post-truth. And so what I hear you saying is, in order to actually communicate the gospel effectively to emerging generations who think in a with their feelings, maybe is one way to say it, and who prefer their own preferences over anything that might be prescriptive in terms of behavior, what I hear you saying is we have to learn to talk to them. We have to learn to present the gospel across that cultural chasm. And what you're equipping us to do in Saving Truth is to do just that.
That's exactly right. I think that the conversation has stopped becoming, you know, it's even funny when we go to college campuses and we're doing these open forums. And I'll tell you, there's a negative part to it and a positive part to it. What I mean by that is a pessimistic and an optimistic part to it. The pessimism side is that the questions are no longer factual. Like, how could I know what you're saying is true, verifiably so? Like, how could I know Jesus rose from the dead? Does science actually lead to faith in God or to rejection of God, can you help me with this? We still get those questions, but the dominant questions are actually questions of preference. They're questions of sexuality, of meaning, of what does it mean to be human. They're still important questions, but they've started shifting away from can you validate your claim to can you validate my preference? And that's a bit of a tricky spot. The optimistic side, though, and this is, I think, this predominates over the pessimism, is that when we go to these universities, whether it's for our missions weeks or we go for these open forums, hundreds, if not thousands, in fact, Robbie and I were at Michigan State University, where 9,500 people filled the Breslin Center to ask their questions, and they were all lined up, all skeptics who lined up to ask their questions. And we were at Yale University, and I think it was like 186,000 people were watching it at once on the live stream, asking their questions, and they were listening for actual answers, which suggests to me that I think our students are seeing that living in a post-truth culture is going to be destructive. So yes, that's what I think we need to do, is to have the conversations, not just give them the truth, but tell them why they should care about what's true in the first place, because we assume they care about it. But the reality is, a lot of folks don't. They just don't care about it because they want their preferences validated, not the not their view of reality validated. And hopefully I've equipped people, and I'm hoping to equip people through the book to do that.
So I think that lines up precisely with what this Pew Research exposes, and that is that, you know, people don't feel like their answers have to be consistent, even over the course of a survey, in terms of what they say about their system of belief. And they lack, when you use the word care, I think that the word that's used by Pew is curiosity. Like, they lack the curiosity to even bother themselves with discovering what might be ultimately true, because they're just operating out of a feelings-based approach to this. So if I'll pose a question here. What's wrong,
sure,
Abdu, if I just, you know, feel like something is true for me? Like, why is that not okay for me to just operate in the world and operate in life based on the things that I feel like are true for me? What's the problem with that?
Well, this gets to the equipping method of how we can actually talk to people about this. This question is perfectly poised to actually elucidate this. If I were to say, why can't I do it with true for me? Who am I hurting? Who am I bothering? Let's give an example. Let's take an example where science is actually – the science is strong, really strong on the consequences of a certain behavior. Let's take the transgender issue where someone says, look, I have a strong – even if they're truly gender dysphoric, they have an honest, real struggle with what their body is and what their mind is telling them they are. And there's a dysphoria, there's a disjunction between the two. And they want a congruence. So they say, I'm going to pick what my mind says, not what my body says. And so they live in this congruence. The studies show, the scientific facts show, that people who have a genuine gender dysphoria and then go through the sex reassignment surgery are 19 times more likely to kill themselves than the rest of the general population, which means that the surgery does not fix and does not help. There's still something internal that needs to be addressed compassionately, and it's not being so. So if you were to say, but my truth is that I feel like a certain way, well, the problem with that is there's consequences to your belief. It's not just in a vacuum. If your beliefs don't line up with the truth, there are very serious negative consequences. And if we were to say further, let's say you don't have actual gender dysphoria. Someone who's got clinical gender dysphoria is a different story. But let's say someone says, like Miley Cyrus. Miley Cyrus made this statement a few years ago where she said, I find myself to be a ageless, genderless soul. These things don't apply to me anymore. Well, that's a nice statement to sound deep and almost like spiritual. But the reality is that people are conflicted or actually do have clarity about their gender, and to suggest that those things don't actually matter because you are an ageless, genderless soul is to take those people's genuine struggle and trivialize it. Mm-hmm. But hey, it's your preference. You can say what you want. I think that there's very serious consequences to that. So just saying it's true because it's true for you ignores the realities of science, of facts, of history, of real people's struggles. That's one aspect of it. And the other part of it, it just might actually end up being false. The fact that someone might say, well, Buddhism is true for me. Well, I realize it's true for you, but it doesn't matter if it's true for you. It matters if it's true, because ultimately do you care about whether or not your belief is true? And if the answer is no, oh, I can't make you care, except to point out the very serious negative consequences of that kind of a belief system. And there are. One other thing is that, it actually leads us to a very serious societal problem. I mean, you think about exactly some things. What if it's wrong? It's true for me that having sex with young children is okay. That can't be right. But you believe it. Well, that can't be possibly be right because there's consequences societally. I think this stems from, Carmen, is our society's obsession with the word freedom, and we've now been so obsessed that we've actually misdefined it. Freedom is not the ability to do whatever you want, whenever you want to, and in whatever way you want to. That's not freedom. That's autonomy. And autonomy is different. Autonomy comes from two Greek words, autos, meaning self, and nomos, meaning law. So we have now entered into, and this kind of thinking of true for me is autonomous. I'm a law unto myself. The problem with that is that if you're a law unto yourself and I'm a law unto myself, and our laws happen to conflict on very serious issues, the determiner between us will not be truth. It's going to be power. And if that's the case, then the person with the loudest microphone or the most guns is the one who's going to win. And that's not the law of civilization. That's the law of the jungle.
Friends, you're listening to Abdu Murray. You can check out what we're talking about at abdumurray.com. That's where information about his forthcoming new book, Saving Truth, is posted. We're going to encourage you to go there and pre-order the book because you get lots of goodies if you do that. Okay, one of my favorite quotes from the book actually uses the word autonomy, so now I'm going to lay it on you since you just used it and defined it for people.
Uh-huh.
The reason I'm reading this is so people can they can hear the beauty of the way you put words together in the book. So here's the quote. When truth is sacrificed as the burnt offering on the altar of autonomy, the resultant smoke chokes the breath out of freedom.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that's what happens is that we say these words, freedom and all these things, and people have fought and died to obtain freedom. But something we forget is that people have fought and died to maintain freedom. It's one thing to obtain it. And that's when, you know, the great movies are like, you know, The Patriot and Braveheart and all these movies about obtaining freedom, or, you know, Amistad and all these wonderful movies that talk about the winning of freedom. That's the sort of the sexy Hollywood part, right? But the reality is the hard work is in maintaining freedom. And freedom to be maintained needs a restraint. Ironically, it needs restraint. And as Oz Guinness so beautifully puts it, the only restraint that doesn't kill freedom is self-restraint. Autonomy is that thing that is the altar upon which we burn freedom, truth and clarity, and it chokes freedom. But self-restraint can actually give freedom more air to breathe. And so I think that we as a culture, and this applies to all of us, not just non-Christians, but even Christians, is to re-understand what it means to be truly free. Autonomy is doing what you want, whenever you want, however you want. Freedom is to do what you want in accordance with what you should, based on what you are. And what you are and what you should comes only from God.
Mm. All right, friends, I know you've got more questions for Abdu Murray. He's actually taking questions this week at something called RZIM Connect. You can check it out at connect.rzim.org. That's connect.rzim.org. You can ask your questions, and he will answer them, I think, through tomorrow. Am I right about that, Abdu?
That's right. I'm answering questions online until tomorrow. And if you can, drop me a line and join the Connect family. It's a family of people who are like-minded and who love to talk about these kind of matters that you and I are talking about and having these conversations online. Feel free to drop me a note as well.
Great. All right, friends, it's abdumurray.com is his website. The book is Saving Truth. Abdu, thank you so much for joining us today on Connecting Faith.
Always a pleasure, and it was an honor. Thank you, Carmen.
Thanks. All right, friends, I've got to take one more quick break. When we come back, we'll be making the connecting point. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Welcome back. So we're going to make the connecting point. This is the portion of the program where I'm going to do my best, not just to tie it all up into a neat bow, but to actually give you some talking points and the ability to sort of look at what's happening in the culture, in the news, and applying the mind of Christ in a very tangible way. So, first of all, a couple of listener feedbacks here just in the last few minutes. I got a college student who's listening who says, "Wow, this is one of my favorite interviews so far. So applicable to our society right now. Clarity is so necessary. Clarity is necessary. Confusion seems to reign in the culture and in the world." I was also reminded when Abdu was talking about gender dysphoria, when he was talking about the very real challenges and issues that families are facing out there with folks experiencing genuine gender confusion, genuine gender dysphoria, and then sort of the pile-on crowd that because it's now become like the popular thing to be confused about your gender, that we now have a lot of people who are doing it because it's the thing that gets them the kind of attention that they're really seeking. Okay, so there is a ministry called Help for Families, and you got to put the number 4 in the middle of that. It's Help the number 4 families.com, helpforfamilies.com. I had a listener who contacted me after a program once where we were touching on this subject, and she's like, "You know, I need some help with this because I believe it was her niece who was, you know, struggling with these issues," and she's just like, "I know that I need to speak truth into her life, and I need to know how to love her in the midst of this, but I don't want her to do these things to herself that she's talking about doing or allowing to be done." And so I directed her to helpforfamilies.com, and I feel confident that that they have been able to answer questions and equip her in ways that I certainly would not be able to. So when there are things that come up in an interview where it reminds me of a conversation that we have had at another point in time, you know, I like to make those connections. I like to connect those dots, so to speak. And so when Abdu was talking about autonomy, when he was defining it, I was hearing like echoes in my mind. I'm like, "Didn't we talk with somebody else about this subject?" And I believe it was John Stonestreet from the Colson Center on Christian Worldview, from Breakpoint. I believe he and I had a similar conversation about the subject of autonomy and the idol of autonomy in the culture today. And so if you want a little more equipping on the same subject matter area, you might reach back at Connecting Faith. It's not called Connecting, but our website is myfaithradio.com, and scroll through the Connecting Faith archive there, and you'll find a conversation with John Stonestreet where we talked about similar things. All right, friends, let me close with where I told you that I was going to close, and that's with the Alfie Evans story out of Great Britain. There's a reason that I'm doing this at this point in the program, and that's because the confusion of secularism leads to all kinds of bad medicine, all right? In this case, like genuinely, actually bad medicine, but it leads to bad practices in the culture. It leads to bad ideas. Bad ideas have consequences, and guess what? Bad ideas have bad consequences. Bad ideas don't have good consequences. And so secularism and socialized medicine in the United Kingdom have led to this situation with Alfie Evans. And Alfie Evans is a 23-month-old toddler. His story illuminates for us, you know, the horrifying realities that result when parental rights are usurped by the state, when people of faith are not allowed to pursue life for their child because the culture of death demands that a group of people, in this case, medical doctors and the support of the court system, actually prevent the parents from taking their own child to get the help that they believe might be life-sustaining and life-giving. Instead, those who have the power to retain the child in their custody in the hospital are saying that, you know, what's in the best interest of the child is that the child would not be subjected to what they would call they want to protect the child from unnecessary prolonged suffering by what? By killing him. You have to decide here if secularism is a theoretical problem or if secularism applied to medicine and then protected by the courts becomes a very real problem in terms of the question of life. Now, for those of you who are pro-life, you have to define what you mean by pro-life. Every time we have the conversation about pro-life, I tell you that I'm pro-life from conception to natural death, which is to say that I believe that when this child was removed from life support, if the Lord had seen fit to take him in that moment, then that would be the appropriate time to let the child die. However, he didn't. All right. The doctors were quite certain that Alfie was brain dead and that he would not breathe on his own when he was removed from life support. And they were wrong. And so now it seems completely appropriate that Alfie should be able to take advantage of what is being offered to him by the Pope, which is travel and accommodation and even citizenship in order that he might get medical care in Italy instead of the United Kingdom. So do you remember Charlie Gard? Do you remember the rights of the parents being usurped in that situation? Charlie Gard, you know, ultimately died. Alfie Evans at this point is still alive. Now, inevitably, he will die, as will each and every single one of us. And the pro-life conversation here is a complicated one. But the conversation about natural rights and the rights of parents and whether or not the state should be the one making decisions about a child's health are the kinds of conversations that you and I need to be having. We need to be having them now in the United States of America because we have not arrived yet at the particular place where the UK has already arrived. Here in the United States, there are laws against the kinds of government intervention. Maybe I should say it this way. There are legal barriers in the United States to the kind of governmental intervention that is taking place in the UK in this particular circumstance. However, there are perverse incentives that are built into the system. And those perverse incentives are really important in conversations like single-payer health care. When we as a country start talking about single-payer health care, and now you're saying, oh, she has moved from religion to politics pretty quickly here. Friends, it's all interwoven. You really can't have a conversation about one thing without having a conversation about everything. And so, yes, we have to talk about education. Yes, we have to talk about health care. Yes, we have to talk about the care of older adults. Yes, we have to talk about the application of real money, dollars and cents, when it comes to making medical decisions. And who's going to make those decisions? Well, if the person making the decision has their hand on the purse strings, then I might remind you that guys like Judas are quick to point out, hey, Lord, that fragrant business that she just popped open and poured on your feet could have been sold for a lot of money to feed the poor. So when the people who are making the financial decisions for the group have what we would call perverse incentives, then the legal and moral assumptions are actually sometimes at odds with what is right and certainly what is righteous. And so in the United States, it would still matter what the will and the concern of the parents were in terms of the moral decision making. That is no longer true in the United Kingdom. And so let's be praying for Alfie Evans. Let's be praying for his parents. Let's be praying that goodness would prevail and calmer minds and hearts would win the day. In the meantime, let's pray the news. Hey, continue to pray today for those related to the Husky refinery explosion in Superior, Wisconsin. Let's pray for everybody, pray with everybody in our 90.5 Faith Radio listening area in Duluth. Hey, those of you in Duluth, let us know what you know when you know it at 877-93-FAITH. You can always call us on that line and you can leave us a message. You can also communicate with me on email, carmen@myfaithradio.com. All right, friends, literally all the time we got here today on Connecting Faith. It's always a blessing to be with you. I'll see you right back here tomorrow. Have a great night and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.